Today I spoke with my good friend and former college teammate, Nicole Ballestero. She gives us some background on her experience as a graduate assistant and how becoming a top assistant immediately afterwards led to some new and challenging tasks. We discuss the different cultures she's been a part of, and in her opinion, what has been the major differences between the very successful teams she's been a part of and the not-so-successful teams. I'm excited to share this episode with everyone, so let's roll it back and see how the conversation went. So, Nicole, my friend.
My friend, Sam.
As a GA at University of Idaho, tell me what were some of your responsibilities that you were given?
When I was at Idaho, let's see, I was a practice player. That was probably one of my biggest responsibilities, which honestly made it a nice transition from playing. It wasn't, you know, too rough of a start from there. And then I also was in charge of like organizing our practice team. So we had a couple guys that were on our team. I had to like semi have like a mini recruiting session at the rec center to find some guys that were, you know, good, but not too good. Outside of practice, I mean, I had to help a lot with the just random stuff with recruiting. Obviously, the coaches were talking to the recruits and doing, you know, all the big work with that stuff. But if they had to do mail outs, if they had to send out, you know, handwritten notes, I was the one sending them out, taking to the mail room, folding them up, putting them in the envelopes. I was in charge of our team newsletter, kind of just helping put it together, giving recaps of games, getting some, you know, little nuggets from players of getting to know them better. So we had some good interaction with our booster club and alumni and stuff like that. Road trips, I was doing random stuff like, you know, grocery shopping, making sure we had snacks. I mean, just a little bit of everything, all the stuff that, you know, other people didn't want to do or didn't think that they had to do. I was kind of just like a catch-all for all of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So after being a GA, you become the top assistant at Division II Concordia University in Irvine. What were then some of the responsibilities that you were given that were new and challenging?
I would say everything was new and challenging at that point, because instead of like having random responsibilities, I had specific things that I had to get done. So like our team travel, I had to talk to our travel agent, make sure that the flight we were booking was okay, then talk to the visiting teams about booking practice times. So like all that detail oriented stuff was huge. I jumped right into doing scouting reports and breaking down film and watching film, which is something I hadn't done before at Idaho. So that was new. We also were a new staff, so we kind of had to come up with a format of how we wanted our scouts to look and what we wanted to include in them. Watching film, so practice film, game film, film on us and the opponent was new to me. Luckily, I still get to be a practice player, so that's still exciting to me. So but yeah, honestly, everything was new. And I think that's kind of what I like about my job, is I'm doing something different every day. I mean, especially with this COVID stuff and not knowing, you know, specifically what's going on necessarily. Like yesterday I was helping like unbox like yoga mats that we gave to all the athletes. And right after practice, we're helping like kids get their academics done. So it's just something new, honestly, every day, which is keeps you on your toes and it's fun.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So early on in your career, I guess it's still early, but
yeah,
you've been at Concordia for a few years now. So even before then, and maybe towards the earlier years at Concordia, who were some of your mentors that you had that you really looked to?
I would say, Ashley Ford, she was my assistant coach when I played down in San Diego. And then she went on to coach at Nebraska, New Mexico State, and now she's the director of ops at a USC.
Wow.
So she always just she always had was great at like building relationships with players. She was like the coach that you could go to if you like kind of messed up, and she was a good buffer between like you and the head coach. She knew like what to filter as far as like, what did the head coach need to know? What did she not need to know? What could she, you know, conflict she could help avoid. So I loved Ashley for that. She's been a big help for me. And then when I was at Idaho, Jerry Jacobson was the assistant coach. One of the assistant coaches there, she's now the head coach at South Dakota School of Mines. They're a Division II also. And Jerry was always super detail oriented and like had everything ready to go. There was like nothing left undone, which is something that I like appreciate now that I have to do all this organizational stuff. Yeah. So I'd say those two were like two of the people I've had like the biggest impacts, on like my path as an assistant coach.
I remember Jerry.
Yeah. She's Jerry's nice. Jerry's cool.
Okay. So you mentioned, Ashley helped you kind of determine some things that maybe the head coach just doesn't need to know, things that the assistants can handle, things that don't need to be brought to the head coach necessarily. And I'm curious to know from an assistant's perspective, now that you have that guidance, what are some examples of things that, hey, I could take care of this myself. I don't even need to bring it to my head coach's table.
I would say as like right now, I'm kind of, you know, still on the younger side and pretty like connected to the girls. So they will open up a lot more to me when it comes to like conflict, if it's within the team, if it's within roommates, if it's, you know, outside stuff. So I would say my biggest thing is filtering, you know, what is a potential like landmine that's going to blow up and become something bigger that's going to affect everyone. Or just saying something like, all right, this is silly. It just needs to be a conversation and it can be taken care of. That I think that academics to me are something, and just our program in general, that Coach Collins is big on. Obviously, like if kids need tutors and stuff like that, like I can take care of that. I can take care of, you know, emailing teachers and helping them if they're going to miss a class because of traveling. But once we start to see like on mid-semester reports that they're not getting good grades, that's when I got to, you know, take it to the next level and figure out what's going on. But yeah, I think just it's a lot of random stuff that, you know, head coaches have to be so worried about everyone. They have to have like their hand in a little bit of everything, and they have to think big picture most of the time. So I like to look at it as, if I can, you know, manage the individuals that I'm in charge of, hopefully nothing should get to the level where it affects the collective group. But then once I feel I'm not equipped to do it, then I can take it to the head coach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then early on, what was the biggest mistake that you made as an assistant, and how did you learn from it?
Oh, biggest mistake, man. Well, this wasn't necessarily a mistake. It was, you know, just something that we learned was, we didn't have refs for our first game. not really our fault. But we just didn't know that how our conference and our like everything operated. Basically, we didn't know that that fell under our responsibility. So our first game, you know, we were warming up, getting ready to go, and just, okay, like 2 minutes left on the clock, someone comes up to me and goes, hey, did you schedule the refs? And I was like, what?
Oh
just
no.
speechless. So that was one of those times where they were like, we're going to have to figure this out. And I was like, okay, someone's got to tell Coach Collins, like, this is going to be brutal. So now we look back at it and laugh. But at the time, that was a pretty big deal. But I mean, I think that moment in general also taught me like not to overlook anything, like things that I assume are taken care of or not my job, maybe. Kind of just doing a quick check-in, like, hey, did this get done? I would say mistakes-wise or things I've learned, I would say just being a little bit more confident in my, I don't know if opinion is the right word, but my viewpoint of stuff. I think in the beginning, I was just so focused at like, okay, I need to get my job done and I want to do a good job, that if my opinion was asked, I was started off as a yes man. Instead of being like, I'm not sure about that, and kind of finding out like, why do you want to do it this way? This is what I see. This is a potential thing that, you know, I might have a better pulse on because I've talked to these girls about this situation. And I think that's probably my biggest learning lesson has been so far, is knowing that like, I do have a good perspective and a feel on what's going on, and not being afraid to voice that, and just not seeing it as conflict. It's constructive, you know, it's only going to make the group better.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. You know, it's funny, your story about the officials. I remember when this actually happened and you told me about it. And hey, a lesson learned is a lesson shared. When I got hired at OCC and our first game was coming around, I kid you not, I went to my athletic director and I said, am I responsible for getting officials? Cause like, I didn't know. I learned from you, like maybe I need to, you know? So it was just one of those things where I was like, okay, I can't make this mistake too. Like I need to figure it out. So yes, I always laugh at that.
If anyone, you know, is at a new place, just make sure, you know, someone's scheduling the officials.
Yes. Very important. Okay. So you've been on some pretty successful teams. You've coached some successful teams. Tell me what maybe the differences have been between the teams that have been the most successful and maybe not that successful.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I mean, I think that as a player, I would have never have realized this stuff. As a coach, now looking back on it, it's like pretty obvious to me why some of these teams were more successful than others. But I think the biggest thing, like on the court, is people buying into their roles and not feeling like their role is minimized because maybe their role isn't scoring. Like maybe their role isn't, you know, being the top defensive stopper. You know, their role might be like, I am going to be the best practice player and prepare these people for their time in the game. And I think the teams that have been most successful that I've been a part of, everyone has bought into their role and they don't see it as like punishment or as being less valued because of it. And also coaching, I mean, it goes coaching wise too. Like I have had to buy into my role of being like a guard coach and actually investing time into, you know, how can I help better prepare them? Stuff like that. So I would say buying into roles is huge. Defining them is huge. And also going along with that is like having a defined culture, because I feel like culture is such a huge thing that, you know, gives people standards to work for and just kind of sets the bar with everything. And if your team and the players are defining the culture through their actions. I think that's huge. Like, you don't want, as coaches, obviously you're going to set the tone for culture, but it's the players that have to carry it out physically most of the time. Mm-hmm. So I think buying into culture is huge. Things with teams that haven't been as successful, I would say, to me, anything that's like fear-based, or you're doing things because you don't want to get in trouble or you don't want to lose, that just never translates. I just think that, you know, you're getting motivation from outside instead of finding it within yourself, wanting to be great, or wanting to do something for your team. And I mean, that also comes from players and coaches. Players can be like shaming and, you know, put people down, and that's not going to work either, because at the end of the day, you're playing alongside these people. So I would say those are kind of the main ones that I can think of.
Mm-hmm. I love that answer. So you moved to culture, and I'd like to know, can you describe, and you don't have to say, you know, at this school, this is what the culture was like. At this school, this was the culture. Just explain maybe the different cultures that you have been a part of.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say that I have been a part of cultures that are definitely fear-based and shaming and yelling and just, you know, they're trying – in my eyes, it was like I was trying to be motivated, but the way that they were motivating me was like, you know, if you don't do this, you're not going to play, you're not going to get this. And I just don't think that rewards based is, and being extrinsically motivated is what, you know, gets it done. So I've definitely been a part of those cultures that have, like, you know, you can pit like teammates against each other. And just kind of make it ultra competitive. Obviously you want a competitive environment, but if we're constantly going at each other to the point where you can't even build a relationship off the court, then that's just not going to work. Mm-hmm. But then I've also been a part of culture that is like super inclusive and, has like approached my growth as a player, like very holistically. Like when I, was playing, I knew that I was valued like beyond my basketball skill set. And I was approached of like, what do you want to do next? Instead of like, what can you do for me right now as a basketball player? So I think culture wise, just making sure that I was, being treated as like a whole person instead of just a basketball player, where the culture is that I felt valued and, you know, it was way easier to buy into my role.
Yeah. Culture is such a broad conversation, but I feel like so many coaches overlook, like you said, the biggest thing with me with culture is, number one, having those expectations, but also seeing that your players bring value to you outside of just what they can do for you on the court, like that transactional relationship. If you play hard, you get playing time, and that's it. If we win games and you graduate, awesome, move on, next class, come in, let's try to win with them and graduate them and move on. Like, it's not this recurring cycle. It's so much more.
And I mean, it's hard because, I mean, I think honestly, the job that you have being in a junior college and only having kids for 2 years, like, to me, that's an even greater challenge of building a culture, just because your turnover is so quick. Like, I get to see a kid mm-hmm. from when they're 18 until they're 22, pretty much. And obviously, they're growing and changing, but I get 4 whole years to... Year one, they're kind of just trying to figure it out. Year two, they're finally seeing, okay, if I buy into this, this is going to be something that's really great and something that I want to be a part of. And then year three and four, they're teaching the new kids, hey, this is how we do it. I can't imagine being, you know, in your shoes, and it's like year one, you know, they're trying to figure out what they're doing and getting their footing. And then by the time they've caught on and, you know, done everything, they're onto their next journey. So, I mean, I applaud you for getting your culture going like you have.
Well, we'll see. You know, it's funny that you say that, because then this is something that I'm still learning, but I think that at least for what I can see for this year is I have some returners who really figured it out as far as what, you know, what Coach Sammy wants, what she expects of us to do, not necessarily on the court, but what I want from them off the court, as far as any deadlines I set for them, their study hall, whatever that may be, they get it. And now year two has come, and the expectation that I have on them is you're telling the freshmen how to get it done. And you know, part of that is because we have so many freshmen that I need them to, in the sense, like help me and help my coaches out by being an extension of the coaching staff. So we don't necessarily, like year two for our leaders are not necessarily, yeah, you're still figuring it out. We hold them to a higher expectation. And maybe that's because my returners are, they're all older, mm-hmm. you know, they all, this is their second, third, or even fourth year in college. Mm. So that could have something to do with it. But yeah, it's interesting, you know, and a lot of people say that the JUCO level is hard because of that 2-year turnaround. But I always try to flip it and say, like, well, I guess, you know, if I have like a really bad culture, I only have it for 2 years.
Yeah. That's awesome.
I don't know.
No, I mean, it makes sense. We just started, because we kind of took a step back this year and just looked at like, what does our culture look like? I think we had a lot more time to do it, just with obviously COVID and all this stuff. But we implemented like a big sister, little sister program. So we have upperclassmen that are big sisters. They're paired up with one underclassman or one new person. So it's, they have that one person to go to. Obviously they're seeing everyone in the collective team, you know, figuring out like, hey, we all wear knee pads. We all dress the same this way, but making sure that they're accountable to someone mm-hmm. that they can directly go to. If like, I don't know how to register for this class. I'm not sure, you know, where do I get my books? Right. That kind of a thing. So they can really see, hopefully, the culture that this kid has bought into. And what it should look like. And it's been pretty cool to see so far. I think it's helped us too, because like I'm getting way less questions of, hey coach, how do I do this? Like they're able to just go to their sister now and figure it out.
Yeah, that's really cool. I like that. If I definitely could see myself doing something like that if I had at least like a more proportionate number of returners. Yeah. But you know, it's funny too, like something that we, and I know we're getting a little off topic here, but nonetheless, whatever, this is my show. I could do what I want.
You are the boss.
That's right. But so something that we've done this year, and really the whole reason behind it is so that, number one, we're just always remaining competitive, but it's kind of like what you said, where they're holding each other accountable. And instead of texting me, hey coach, how do I do this? Or whatever the case may be, they're now reaching out to one another. Is we call it Orange Coast Olympics. Nice. And it's an inner squad competition. So I have 21 players and we have 5 OCO teams. And so now, instead of like, you have 21 players on your team, if one person doesn't like log into Zoom on time, it's like, whatever, I didn't log into Zoom, coach is going to say something about it. But now if you don't log into Zoom on time, your
OCO team loses points. And like your teammates are like, hey, man, I'm trying to win this competition at the end of the season. Like, you need to get in on time.
Yes.
And now it's them telling them to be on time, and it's not me lecturing the team. I don't know. It's something that I think is going to help us, as far as they don't want to let each other down. You know, maybe they don't want to let me down. Maybe they don't. I don't know. But it's definitely more so geared towards them working with each other and not wanting to let one another down, because that's much more difficult to face than disappointing me, I feel like.
Oh, absolutely. Because then also you're, you know, fostering like a player led team. Mm-hmm. And I think that those are also the most successful teams. Like, if you're a coach led team, you're telling them what to do, and it's coming from like an authority standpoint. But if they're being led by their teammates, who are their peers, who are also literally physically in this battle with them, it means way more, because from their perspective, like, they didn't see me play. They don't know that I physically went through some of the same things. It's hard to, you know, imagine that. But if they can be led by someone that is like physically and mentally going through the same thing every day, it makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah, it makes my job easy too, because now I don't have to have conversations with them about getting stuff done. I just sit behind the computer and I add and take points away. They're the ones having the conversations.
Keep those math skills sharp.
Yeah. Thank goodness for Google Excel. But okay, back on track.
I think that was on track.
I guess so. Now that I'm giving all my secrets away. No, I'm just kidding.
Hey, if we can help one, you know, we'll do it.
That's true. So I'm curious to know, do you think that there's anything that head coaches are doing just too much of, or maybe they're doing not enough of with their teams? And we've kind of talked about this, but maybe if you can go into more detail.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. To me, I look at like, gosh, coaching is rough, obviously, because rough in the sense of like, you have so many things to be on top of. Mm-hmm. And to think that you would have to add more to your plate is overwhelming at times. But one of the things that I think sometimes coaches do too little of is checking in on kids as far as like follow up from before or after practice, or before or after you notice like something's off. I mean, I listened to your episode with Coach Faulkner from Point Loma, and just hearing her say like, if a kid's having a bad day, they're texting me and saying, hey coach, I'm on my way to practice, but this and this happened, and it's threw me for a loop, and I'm just a little out of it. Just giving you a heads up. I think that's really great that she has that relationship with them. And obviously it's taken time. And I think that is something that is big, that coaches can kind of start to build that bridge, because players are only going to get more comfortable, you know, voicing things themselves. And I think it just helps a kid feel like they're seen. I mean, you have 21 kids on your team. We have like 19 on our team right now. Like, people can get lost in the shuffle because you look at them and you're like, oh, they did good today. They are getting good grades. They're doing this. But like, there could be something going on. They just handle it a little better than someone else might. Mm-hmm. So to me, I think that the emphasizing that, like the, you know, emotional intelligence of it is big. And then also just prepping kids for their next step and what they want to do, and using like our resources as coaches to help them with that. It's just like a huge thing that I think I take it a little more personally, because I'd still felt like I didn't know what my next step was. And I never felt like anyone helped talk through that with me, because it was just so focused on like basketball, which is fine. That's what we're all here to do. But I mean, at the end of the day, these girls aren't going to play basketball for forever. They're going to, you know, mm-hmm. go on to be bosses, be, you know, CEOs. They're going to be employees. They're going to have to employ and interview people. They're going to be, you know, we have a kid that wants to be a nurse, a doctor, all that stuff. So just kind of prepping them for their next step is something that I think that we could do a little more of.
Absolutely. I completely agree. You know, and that's a big reason why I found myself at the junior college level is because I guess you could say somewhat want to play a little hand in responsibility and in helping these kids get to the next step. So hopefully I don't mess it up.
You won't.
You're my friend. You're supposed to say that.
No, you are a good mentor.
All right. Coach B, aka the Wizard.
The Wizard. That was my new nickname that I have taken on.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. It makes sense too. Because, you know, you're the wizard. You can see, you have eyes in the back of your head. Money mid-range, for those of you who are listening, if you didn't know that about Coach B, she's money. I say all that in your introduction, so I'm not going to brag about you more here. My final question.
Yes.
Is Coach B, if you weren't a coach, if you weren't Coach B, what would you be doing?
Oh, that's a great question. I didn't even know that I was going to become Coach B. That's the thing. That's, you know, just how it happened. If I was not a coach, I mean, obviously I somehow would like to be involved within sports still. It's, you know, what I've known. But I think that working somehow in like the activism / like sports agency side of things would be cool. I think obviously being inspired with seeing, you know, all the things that athletes are doing right now with what's going on in the world, and then seeing the companies that are behind that. I mean, there's great agencies like Wasserman is a big sports agency that I've kind of looked at as far as like, you know, how they're helping their athletes use their voice. And then, yeah, I mean, I think that's something that I would enjoy doing, obviously still being in sports, but using that platform to better the world around me, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I love that a lot.
Thanks.
I think that no matter what you do, you're going to be great at it. You have been great at everything ever since you waltzed into my life back at Vanguard.
Well, I was, you know, surrounded by some pretty great people, and you were definitely one of them. I couldn't have gotten here without you, Sam.
Oh, shucks. Here we go.
Don't get us started.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. You are awesome. You're one of my bestest friends, and just so fun to talk to. I appreciate you doing this with me.
Yeah, right back at you. Thanks for doing this. And hopefully, you know, we make sure that everyone has referees at their game now.
Yes.